Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll, Lord. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil runs his groove in them rhythm and blues that sin. It's gonna get you some in the end.
Welcome back to The Speakeasy. I'm Damon Bolte, and I'm flying solo today as both of my co-hosts are out of town, and good for them. You know, that's part of the reason why I brought on two co-hosts. One, to start with, Souther in the beginning, and then during the pandemic, we brought on Greg. And the reason why is because, you know, we're busy people, and we travel a lot, and we do lots of cool stuff within this industry, and what a great thing to be able to do. So, that said, today, it's going to be me and our guest today. I want to say apologies for last week's show because we had a guest that also was very busy and double booked themselves. So they will be coming on the show at a later date. But, you know, it's good that we're all very busy. And speaking of that, I have four different bottles of whiskey in front of me. So we're going to be pretty busy today with our guest who, again, another very busy person. So busy, but made time to be on the show today. Alan Laws, welcome to the show. This is going to be fun. You are a whiskey producer in Colorado, you're in Denver right now, and it's one of my favorite cities, which I explained earlier. it's a weird explanation based on the fact that it's where I got into a motorcycle wreck when I was like 21 and changed my life. but I love Denver. It's an amazing city. You know, I'm from Oklahoma, and I used to go there all the time on tour. I still go there often to just go for different like work events and visit some friends and whatnot. And it's just a cool place to be. And you actually got started in your whiskey career in New York City. We both lived in Carroll Gardens, Brooklyn. I still have an apartment there and a bar there. So yeah, I can't wait to get into this and talk to you about it. But ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the show. Alan Laws of Laws Whiskey House in Colorado.
Thanks.
How are you today?
I'm good. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is going to be fun. Can't believe that most people don't know where Carroll Gardens is. So I think that's really cool. You knew that.
Yeah, totally. Well, to me, it's one of the more classic neighborhoods in Brooklyn, right? Brownstone Brooklyn, as they call it. It's like Carroll Gardens and Park Slope are those, you know, kind of two main kind of old school neighborhoods. But Carroll Gardens is a little bit more, you know, there's more like on Smith Street and Court Street, there's definitely more commercial kind of situation. There, you know, Clover Club's there, Leanda. There's just like a bunch of really great cocktail bars and restaurants, cool little shops and stuff. I mean, it's just, and it's constantly evolving and changing. And it's just, it's a really beautiful place. It's all walkable too. You know, that whole area, they call it Bococa, which is Borum Hill, which is where Grand Army, my bar, is. And then Cobble Hill. So Borum Hill, Cobble Hill, and then down to Carroll Gardens. I just kind of call it all Carroll Gardens because that's where my apartment was. And, you know, I could walk to work. It would actually take me longer to a lot of times, like my walk was about 12 minutes. You know, I'm living in the Bay Area of San Francisco now, but it was like about 12 minutes walk from door to door, or I could get an Uber or ride my bike. And that was about like 5 minutes. But the 12-minute walk ended up taking about 35 to 40 minutes because it's so neighborhoody and you see everyone when you're walking around and like you had to shake hands and kiss babies and all that stuff. Just a cool area to be. But you were on Wall Street in New York City, right? Wow. Tell us about that.
Well, so I worked for Merrill Lynch and I worked for Merrill Lynch in Canada first. I'm originally from Western Canada and Alberta. Oil and gas finance is what I did. And I did that from like my whole life, basically. And Wall Street was a great place to do that on. I never really worked anywhere in my life that I didn't love what I did. I did this for 15 years. So I spent about 6.5-7 years in Brooklyn just after 9/11. So that's when we moved there. Very different place at that time. It was good. And it was... Well, that's what got us out here. Also, too.
Yeah,
came from Calgary to here, to there, to out here, and that was a move from Merrill Lynch to buy a bank out here and moved me out here to lovely Denver, Colorado.
Yeah, I mean it's interesting to me because I was kind of mentioning this before the show. There seems to be I know quite a few people in New York who left Wall Street to get into the wine and spirits industry, mostly on the spirit side. My buddy Stephen D'Angelo, who owns Green Hood Gin-Smiths, and my friend Bridget Fertile, who owns Oney's Rum, and countless others. It just seems like a natural progression. I imagine a lot of that has to do with people in banking and finance and Wall Street liking the sauce a little bit. I mean, if this were the 80s, this show would probably be about cocaine. But, but you know, it seems like a natural thing. They kind of go hand in hand, right? I mean, you've got like, especially being down there, you've got like the second PJ Clarks, you know, and like nowadays there's like the Dead Rabbit. There's just a lot of like kind of classic places to drink down there in that area.
Well, that's what you do with clients, right? So that's
right.
The thing to get people out and to get
closer
them
than a golf course,
and
right?
All those things. Oh, way better than a golf course.
So
not a big fan of golf, Mike, personally.
I'm left-handed, so like I've never really done it. But I've hung out at a lot of golf courses and mostly clubhouses. But yeah, you know, it's funny too, because you're from Calgary. I actually, through this show, I think just this industry in general, like every industry has its kind of like connectivity socially and whatnot. And you make a lot of friends. And, you know, even if you like kind of switch companies and whatnot, you know, you kind of move around. It's like you kind of have like you're kind of bonded by the work that you do. Right. And so
for sure,
in this industry and in the spirits industry, especially, it's like you're really bonded in a lot. Like whenever I travel around, I'll just hit up whoever and be like, hey, who do I know in, you know, Paris or, you know, Hamburg or wherever. And then I get a billion replies and they're like, oh, you should go say hi to so-and-so. I'm like, I didn't realize they moved here. Like they own a bar here now.
Yeah.
But then, you know, you have this like kind of interesting, like trust within the industry. And one of those things that happened to me through this show, a friend of mine named Craig, he is brand ambassador for a non-alcoholic Amaro company called The Pathfinder. And he lives in New York now, but he's from Alberta. And we were talking on the show one day, and I was asking him, you know, kind of the origin story of like how he got into the industry. He's like, well, you know, I'm a musician, I'm a drummer, and I used to like be on tour all the time. And I'd always go and try to find the coolest bars and like the quirkiest like spirits. And that's how he got into Amaro. He's like, yeah, but I'm from Alberta, you know, Calgary, you know, that area where you're from. And I had just been looking for this very rare guitar, extremely rare because it's left-handed, this vintage guitar. And it was there on a website called Kijiji. Do you know that one? It's K-I-J-I-J.
I don't, but one of my friends is a drummer and he used to order stuff from there. Yeah.
It's like a
covers for his drums and that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Anyway, I was trying to get this guitar in the United States. And anyway, it was COVID, you know, it was like a few years ago. And I was going to fly to Calgary and like, stay at one of the hotels. And like, yeah. And then I realized I had to quarantine for 14 days. Anyway, through this show and through this industry and the trust it's built, I still haven't met Craig in person or his friend who lives in back there in Canada. But I wired like $6,000 blindly across the border to get this guitar. Three people I've never met in person, to $6,000 gone. The guitar showed up. It's freaking perfect. It's the only one that ever existed from 1969. And I think that's something cool about this industry. You know, it's like there's just really cool connectivity and like there's like a trust, you know. So it's just fascinating, you know, the people you meet and the places you'll go. And this brought you into the booze world. You know, like you were on Wall Street. You were already very much into whiskey, right? And then that was a really good time.
Yeah, that started really early on.
It's a really good time to be in a whiskey, too, in the aughts, because this is before, this is right when people were starting to learn about it, American whiskey specifically. And you could still buy a bottle of Van Winkle rye for like $40 on the shelf and it had a layer of dust on it because people thought that was too expensive.
Yeah.
You know?
All true. Yeah.
You got into it at the right time. So, yeah, tell us about that path and like how you got into it, how you wanted to, like where you started getting into the idea of building a distillery. Was it before you moved to Colorado with the job, or was it after, or a little bit of both?
It was before. When we lived in Brooklyn, we were looking at doing this. So I'd already started the research. I'm a research analyst. So like read all the book, like read everything I could find. And there was not a lot that you could find, you know, 13 years ago. And so we, you know, spent about 5 years researching what we wanted to do and, you know, just kind of getting familiar with it. So I started, whiskey's my thing since I was 16, and I could tell you, oh, I'm passionate about this and all these things. You just go, yeah, I've heard that story before. No, it's obsession. So this is beyond like passion. It's obsession with whiskey. Started with Jack Daniels, like I was 16. Remember, I'm from Canada. It's very much liberal there. No one
sure to
care about those sort of things. Here, it's like, you know, very tough on the 21 and all that kind of stuff, but not back then. And, you know, wanted to get into this, and I feel, oh, you have I had a collection sort of at one point, and collections only build because you don't have time to drink it. That's all. So you buy stuff and you didn't get around to drinking it, or you finish it and it just becomes a collection. And that's, for me, that's how it sort of started. And then I'm like, wow, I like this. I like that. I don't really like Canadian whiskey. I love American whiskey. I always have Jack Daniels, Wild Turkey. Those were the things that I thought were the best. And as I moved through that, found a whole bunch of other things and went into Scotch and then pulled away from Scotch and ultimately just went and say, well, what do I like the best? And I'm like, ah, well, I like these. And could you make a whiskey that has all the elements of these combined? And that's what Law's Whiskey House is.
Cool. I mean, it's interesting to me that you would say that you know, starting with like Jack Daniels and Wild Turkey, which I think are like their staples or standards. I think like the thing that got me into like the deep rabbit hole of American whiskey, I was working, it's before this, but I was working at a little whiskey shop in Red Hook called Linnell's, and I still have some Red Hook rye, but and a lot of other stuff, but that's the collection stuff, right? That's that, you don't want to finish that because that's the saddest day. But you know, before that, I was getting into, you know, I was a Maker's Mark, you know, like the ambassador program where you get your name on a barrel and then, you know, 7-8 years later, you get to buy bottles out of it or whatever. Your name's on a plaque with like 30 other people, you know, but like I did that. I signed up for that. And like, I was still living in Oklahoma. It must've been like 2003 or something. That program's long gone. But to me, that's kind of what got me into the deeper cuts of American whiskey was like the fact that they had, you know, there was only one SKU of Maker's Mark back then. But then, you know, occasionally they would put out a limited edition bottle, same juice, it's just a different package, you know, like for Ed Samuels Sr.'s birthday or some monumental birthday or whatever. Or like they had like big college games, you know, like playoffs, they would do special labels and special colored wax. And like eventually, you know, sometimes they would do mint juleps and have green wax. And so it was like that thing, that to me is what got me really into the deep dive into like, you know, the surface level of like what Maker's Mark is to a lot of people. To, you know, now it's different because of all the different cask strength and finishes and all that stuff and the 46 and whatnot. But back then it was like, whoa, it was like finding a rare guitar, you know? And that's where the collectability came from for me. And then same thing with Wild Turkey too. You'd mentioned Wild Turkey and, you know, like different shoots, like shoot offs, like American Spirit and Rare Breed and, you know, things like that. And it's like, oh, wow. Okay. So it's not just the 101. There's like a bunch of other stuff to dive into. And then that kind of starts making you feel like a pseudo expert because you know a little bit more than just like the base level. So to me, that's it's cool that you started that way, and that, you know, like a lot of people kind of shit on, you know, the big brands like Jack Daniels and whatnot.
No, you can't do that.
Like, you can't, man. You got to pay respect.
Yeah, I think if everyone wants to compare craft spirits to craft beer, and like I'm like, it's not the same. So craft beer came out with, you know, they're filling a huge void that was left with, you know, big companies that only produced a single thing or a couple things, and it was on the basis of cost mostly. And they weren't super great. They weren't into new flavors or experiences. And so craft beer had like a different type of runway than craft spirits does. There's still a runway, but when you look at the larger companies that I guess we compete against now too, or we're underneath the umbrella of all those, they make amazing stuff. whether it's Jim Beam, whether it's, you know, Heaven Hill or Makers, or like, they all make amazing projects. Like, my favorite whiskey outside of our own is, like, I love Old Forester. Like, it's been a natural progression from Jack Daniels into Old Forester, because bourbon was a little bit more palatable for me than Tennessee whiskey. That doesn't mean I won't order Jack Daniels, though. Yeah. And so those things, like, you look at those companies and they've been around a long time and they make really high quality spirits. So it's not the same thing for spirits companies, small, like a little tiny one like us, to come into this and say, oh, we're going to change the world. All we're trying to do is add to, you know, these white spaces, threads in the fabric of American whiskey. You want to be part of the great tradition, but we're not trying to change the world or say we can. We are Maker's Mark in 1955. Well, maybe put it, they started 54. Say 1960. We're Maker's Mark in 1960.
Like, sure.
In a much smaller scale. That's when, you know, they started in the 50s. And that was like one of the.
Yeah. They started in producing things. In 51 and they launched in 58. And so you're 61. You're basically, or yeah. Like, you know, so something like that. When you launched your first, it would have been like 1961. So
yeah.
On that note, I mean, what was the first, you started laying stuff down in barrels, was it 2011
or? Yeah, 2011, we made a first batch. So moving up towards that in 2009, we finished
on the 4th of July
research.
I read.
It was, yeah. Born on the 4th of July.
Wow.
Made by a Canadian. I'm a U.S. citizen as of last June. I'm very proud of that.
Nice. Congrats.
And made by Canadian in Colorado on the 4th of July. That was our first batch. And, you know, from there, we just sort of took our time. So we only made 10, 12 barrels a month for the first 6 months. And during that time, spent a lot of time dialing stuff in.
True.
And, you know, at the very end of the research period, we went to Kentucky, saw how it was done in large format. And at that time, no one cared. Like in 2009, no one cared about, you know, little companies like us. And they were all, you know, most of them shut down for over a month in the summer just to do turnarounds and that kind of thing. So it was a different time. You know, like I said, our research going into this, I bought 10 years of Malt Advocate back issues to read. I read them all before we went into this. I had to understand like the commercial side of the business, and it's very complicated, more so than people think. Yeah. But all this research led us to go there to see how it's done and meet the folks that do it. And during the time we were there, we got introduced to Bill Friel, who was ex-master distiller for Barton's, or Old Tom, I think is what they used to call it. And it was owned by Sazerac then. And, you know, we met him from, you know, happenstance, basically, and, you know, spent a bunch of time with him. And he's like, son, you sound like you want to do it the right way. If you want to do it the right way, I could do some consulting for you. But if you do not want to do it the right way, you're not going to listen to what I tell you, then, you know what, I got better things to do in my retirement. So we, you know, got connected with him, and he's the last piece of the puzzle for us, in that I knew how to make it. We had bought the equipment. We were, you know, applying for a DSP. We were established in a building that we'd bought here in Denver, and we were ready to go. And then there's this aspect that most people maybe ignore, but American whiskey has soul, right? Like, so to get that soul, it's a human that does it. There's not a lot of like mechanical things that can allow you to just achieve this. It's really about taste and what you're trying to achieve. And when you're new, like I was to it, I was like, what am I supposed to do here? And, you know, the still's flowing. We're supposed to make a heads cut. I look over at Billy, well, all the terrible stuff is gone. It's starting to sweeten up. Like, where do I cut it? And the story I tell a lot, he's like, son, that's your own goddamn whiskey. Make your own goddamn cuts. And I'm like, what? So I reverted back to like a, you know, technical numbers thing and estimated what my heads might be, 5%, and did a calculation on my phone. I'm like, okay, I'm going to cut it like 5 gallons, given the flow rate and the proof. And that's how I started. And then I just started dialing that back every time I did it, until I reached a point where I'm like, this is the flavor that I'm looking for. And then it was all sensory. You have to do it by sensory. And even our folks who go through it now on the floor, everyone's trained the same way, but it's really looking for certain esters. When it hits that, that's when we make, you know, cut the tank from the tails cut, or from the heads cut. Tails are very similar, a little bit more difficult, I think, but same thing.
Yeah, and that's the cool thing about craft distillation too, is like, you know, having a small team. There's a lot of QC with the larger distilleries, and that's great because like for continuity and consistency of flavor, you know, for if you're going to buy a 1.75 liter of something, if you drink that much of, you know, whatever, Bullet or Makers or whatever, it's like great to like have that be consistent, you know, a constant in your life and in your cocktail or however you drink your spirit. That's great. I love going back because speaking of that time of around the late aughts that you were referring to and the kind of attention paid to small craft whiskey distilleries. I mean, Tuttletown, that was a big one. There was a lot of pushback. I remember when I was working at Linnell's, we were the first people to carry it, the very first account ever. And we got a lot of pushback for a $40 375 of a whiskey no one's ever heard of. And it was still very green back then, you know, the flavor of the whiskey. So, I mean, when you say whiskey has soul, it's like, yeah, it sure as shit does, man. Because like, there's very much, especially on a smaller scale, like a craft distillery size, you've got those different people making cuts. You're tasting it. Your palate's going to evolve over time too. And like your taste, like your actual, like your barrels and the weather and the grain that you're getting. I mean, mm-hmm. it's very symphonic, right? You've got to kind of work with it, with, yeah. I mean, it's like it's kind of like
everything changes. Everything.
Yeah, exactly.
Know, everything, yeah. Everywhere. It changes all the time. So you're not really trying to homogenize stuff. You're trying to make decisions on which way you, every batch you might make a small adjustment, but you're making that on the basis of the barrels you're using are all going to be different. They were made in different years typically. And so every time you make a step up, we started with like about a 3-year-old whiskey. And as of next month, our flagship bourbon there'll be nothing in it under 4. And it's mostly 4 now, but we like the ability to add some, you know, stuff 3.5, add some fruity notes. But you don't just go, hey, here's the barrels of the age, pour them all into a tank. You don't do that. So to make a batch now, ours are typically 100 barrels, and we're going to pick from 200 barrels. And we're going to pick ones that are on flavor profile. And this, and the guys go through it. It takes weeks, not days. It takes weeks. Oh, yeah. And you find that core of about 60, 70 barrels that are dead on. And then you provide the whole production team with 2 variants, or maybe sometimes 3 variants. Something that's spicy and dry, something that's sweet and fruity. And then we compare it to the prior batches to the extent that, you know, we're pretty good at that already. We already know what we're looking for. So it comes down to, okay, well, which way are we going to go?
Yeah, you got your tasting profile notes, and you kind of go along with those and make sure that you're tasting what you're getting is lining up with what the expectations are.
It takes time, though. It takes a lot of time. So,
yeah.
And the bigger the batch, I think in some ways the longer it takes, but it becomes a little easier because you have some homogenization of, you know, if we do everything at the front end and are really tight on that, then we produce at least the spirit before it goes in the barrel is very tight, and it has become that over the years. And then put it in the barrel and let Mother Nature and, you know, different, you know, wood and air and barometric pressure is a big deal out here in Colorado. So that makes the barrels pump like a heart because of the pressure swings, more so than just temperature gradients that vary. You know, these are all things that affect, and clearly every year is different.
Yeah. And that's kind of the magic of it, right? Like, take the wheel, Mother Nature, and like, see where you go. And I just love that, you know. And I learned from Hugh Benjamin Rabin, legendary brandy producer. He was like, man, he's like, you gotta make sure that distillate is right on. He's like, the barrel's not going to save it. You know, I think a lot of times,
no, especially, it's not.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's sometimes will accentuate the mistakes, right? It has the ability to. And I think there's something about, I think that thought for a lot of people, it's kind of like a crutch, right? Like just because of all of the barrel-aged cocktail programs and bars and hotels and restaurants and things like that, it's not everything is better thrown in a barrel. You know, the barrel doesn't make everything better, right? And so I've had a lot of really interestingly, like, I'd say I'm not going to name names of bars or restaurants, but like failed attempts at barrel aged cocktails because, like, what that's not going to. It's just going to be. It's going to come out weird, like in the end. But like, it's really up to the quality of what goes into the barrel. You know, like you got to. It's like the mouthfeel.
Well, especially, wait till like, you get to like special finish where you have something that's already great that you like that's 3+ years old, then you go, I want to put it in this French oak Armagnac barrel. And what if it, or our bad experience with the sherry, I'm like, this tastes terrible. And so that's you're at a point where you're like, oh, and the natural thing to do in that is like, oh, well, we'll just let it go longer and longer. And it got worse and worse. Yeah. And eventually you're like, hey, I have a 400 liter Oralosa sherry finish four grain that's 7 years old that still sucks. So we redistill it.
Damn.
Literally, you're like, this is never going to be good. And
you know, wasted just, all that time, man, all that time and effort, yeah. You know, and it's like, God, well,
but you have to. Yeah, you do. And you have to wade in. So on special finishes for us, we started out with everything we do has to have like a null hypothesis, right? This is economics, math. So you have to come up with like, why are we doing this? And what are we going for? And that usually works out pretty well. We haven't had many that didn't turn out, but we have had some. And we go into that going, okay, this is what we're doing. And then when you first start, you're going to do this for like, okay, well, we put it in there. And then 6 months later, like, I think this is good. It tastes like this. And then we bottle that for the tasting room. And like, okay, let's see how people react to it. And then you're like, whew, wow, that was good. And then like, well, what if we let it sit in there longer? And then everyone gets kind of like, well, you know, it tastes pretty good there. I'm like, well, why don't we see what happens to the integration and the oxidization over that time? And then we push it out to a year. And we got really comfortable with those sort of things. And things like Cognac and Armagnac and Madeira is our latest one. Very good. And all these barrels have impart something on it. And at the same time, they're still integrating, they're still breathing, they're still aging. So all these things are really important. And so most of our finished stuff is 5 to 7 years old by the time it's done. And we've created something different. And these take years. Like people go, oh, you just experiment and then you go, no, this takes like years.
Yeah.
Even absolutely. If your own stuff and your, you know, our four grain is what we started with. Again, trying to add to the fabric of American whiskey. And the catalyst for this was the grainy Woodford Reserve Master's Collection from 2005. That was I'm like, oh my God, this is so grainy and so interesting. And it was on the goosenecks that they had. And we only use pot stills. So that was an inspiration to me. I'm like, I want to make something like this. And that's how we started out. And we're like, okay, there aren't many. We'll do that. And then from there, all of our other whiskeys are just a deconstruction of the four grain. So make them the same way, get them the closest to 100% of that grain as possible. And it's all possible. And then sort of, you know, break down those flavors as they contribute to the four grain. That's started with rye, then went to wheat whiskey. Both of those for us today are 100% rye and 100% wheat. And then the barley was all barley, obviously, but you know, you can use complex recipes using, you know, Abbey, Prince, chocolate malt, caramel malts. Caramel 60 is what we use, but it's really like a caramel 120, like that's what we used to make it. Now, after we did years of that, we're like, oh, that's really cool. But why don't we deconstruct what we do in barley? So let's make base malt with a modifier, base malt modifier. And then and then you can use those as paints on a palette to create something very unique and amazing.
Well, so I got the sample bottles in the mail like a while back. I want to say it was almost 2 months ago. And I'm surprised I have any left in the bottles. But the one that's the lowest wash line right now that I'm looking at is the four grain straight bourbon whiskey. And, you know, I just like you, I was really drawn by that Woodford Reserve four grain. And it was back when they did the Sonoma Kutcher finish, you know, in that special shape bottle.
Sweet mash.
Yeah, totally. And that was the first four grain I ever had. I know that shortly after that, you know, Tuttle Town came out with their Four Grain. A few years after that. And I was just drawn to Four Grain. Like, it's just such an interesting style of American whiskey that I can't believe more people don't do it, honestly. Because, I mean,
it's tough to do.
Yeah, I mean, but, you know, it's all tough to do.
Well, but rye takes over. Like, our mash bill is 60% corn, 20% wheat, 10% rye, and 10% barley malt.
Okay.
So, but at the beginning, that 10% of rye, like, really overpowered everything else. So we had to change cooking technique is what we altered. And so we cook it with the corn and take it up to higher temp, which denatures some of its, you know, feistiness. It's still there. You can't get rid of that. And so that allowed for the balance to come through, with wheat being double its constituent component of the mash bill. And then, you know, wheat is pretty prominent in our whiskey. And when you can see that when you try the wheat whiskey, you know, 100% wheat whiskey, you know, oh, I see it. It's right there. But, you know, you have to learn through iterations to kind of find that. And, you know, our current, what's in the bottles we sent you, the sample bottles, is, you know, average age is over 4, but there's 3.5 in it. There's some 4 in it. And that's kind of where we think that we get what we're looking for in our 4-grain, which is to be more grain forward and fruit forward. So you're getting the grain more than the barrel. You do get barrel, but not in an overpowering way. And then about 2 years ago, we decided to add something to the folks that prefer the barrel side of things. And we added some 10-year to that batch. So we 5% 10-year that goes into our batches as well. So that gives you an extra layer. But you still get all 4 American mother grains in every sip. Sweetness of the corn, kind of bite of the rye, and then this doughy, you know, baking spice thing of the wheat, and then nuttiness from the barley. All of our grains are heirloom varietal. So they're grown in a specific place, and they're a specific varietal, and they present differently than commodity grain.
And I get it all on the nose, too. I mean, that was one of the things that, you know, growing up on a farm in Oklahoma, you know, we grew wheat and rye and corn. There was a little barley at one point, but on a different farm site. And, like, I just remember walking through and just the smell of it, you know, just as the fresh grain, you know, during harvest time and whatnot. And, like, you know, that was one of the first things about 4-grain whiskey that got me. It was like, you know, your olfactory is like your strongest sense memory. And, like, it just took me back home. And it really tripped me out that something like, I feel like all my other experiences with whiskey kind of took me to a different place, like away from home. Like it was more exploratory, you know, like especially with Scotch and like Irish whiskey. And there weren't very many Japanese whiskeys back then. But even with American whiskey, it was like it took me to Kentucky or Indiana or Pennsylvania. But then the 4-grain took me back to Oklahoma, the Oklahoma-Texas border. So it was like crazy. That. And like that happened with this one too. I really appreciate that, first of all. But, you know, like, I've got them all lined up here. And the next one I poured, because you were talking about wheat a lot, I've got the next one in my glass is the wheat. And I love it. It's like not even 10 o'clock here in California, and I've got 4 whiskeys in front of me. See, this is the best industry to be in, just saying. But I will say that I want to do like a little sidebar on this, because my background is in graphic design, print, and I love that you've got a screen printed bottle. I just got to say that, like, you know, like, it pissed me off when Topo Chico went from screen printing to like a clear sticker on their bottles. So I really appreciate that these are actually screen printed.
Those are our, like, we do the four pack you got. That's a product for us to get people to really take the trip of, hey, here's 4-grain. Here's a deconstruction of these things. Take you on a grain flavor trip. We're about flavor, right? The grain flavors are important to us. Cool. So, and the wheat, like, this is like what the normal bottle of wheat looks like.
Cool. Yeah.
And they're all bonded. So they all follow the Bottle and Bond Act. And our wheat, what's in your bottle, is probably 5 and a half years old.
So it says aged at least 2 years. And then also on the alcohol by volume, it says 47.5. So that's 95. So I guess this wouldn't be bonded.
No, those are all cut and those, but the 2 year on it, it's just because we had to get them screened and we're just like, well, if we ever want to, it needs to be a straight whiskey. We're not gonna put out any, but we've never put out anything in under three or around there. Like it's not really what we're interested in doing, but we have in an experimental stuff, trying to understand people's reaction to it, do a small batch of something, go, okay, here's this, it's 2 years old. And like, what do you think? What are things you react to? So we've done that mostly through the tasting room. But we're now at 7 years for this year. We have a trio of bonded whiskeys that all come out now. Like the bourbon is 7 years old, not eight this year. We picked 8 7-year old barrels for, we pick on which ones we like. And this year it's like a caramel bomb with,
that's what worked.
Yeah, with like a cool, what I think is cool is that's cool corn sour mash finish, which is like, this is the one I want to do. What does everyone think? Because I like that in Kentucky whiskey too. So that's our 7-year bourbon this year. And then our 7-year old dry, also bonded. That's what we've been putting it out at. We're pretty comfortable in that area. And then this year, the same bonded wheat 7. They all come out in this time of year.
So I got to ask.
And the wheat is particularly good in the summer because you put it on ice and all those notes of orange and orange Pico tea really react. And also there's often a root beer sarsaparilla note to it that I quite really like.
Yeah, same.
And a root beer.
That's actually what I was going to ask. like when you started getting into this, were you drinking cocktails or was it whiskey straight rocks? Like
that's a great question.
All of the above.
I don't really like cocktails. Like I really can't handle the sugar. As I got older, I became, type 2 diabetic. So they're not my friend. We'll put it that way. So I like it just straight, but I appreciate folks using it to create certain cocktails. And it's amazing what folks can do with it. We have our new tasting room that will open in the next 8 weeks, I expect. And it has a high-end cocktail bar in it, which I think will be another way to showcase our whiskeys and what they bring to the table in classic cocktails or in new world cocktails. So we expect that to be a big deal for us going forward.
Yeah. I mean, people like their cocktails these days, especially in Denver, Colorado. You have a Death and Company there. That's kind of a crazy thing when you think about like all the places they were going to put a Death and Company and they put one in Denver. That just goes to show like that town lacks its drinks. But this to me, I've just tasted the rye, which is very, it's got a lot of spice to it. It's like, it's freaking good. But now I'm on the Henry Road straight malt whiskey. So I'm kind of fascinated by American malt whiskeys. You know, like we think about malt whiskey, you think about scotch. But just like in general, I guess just malt whiskeys around the world too. Cause I mean like, Japanese malt whiskeys, even like the Australian malt whiskeys and like American malt whiskeys are fascinating to me because they can go in so many different directions. And especially when it comes to, I mean, like I'm a big cocktail guy, right? I own a cocktail bar. I appreciate the spirits, naked or straight or whatever you want to call it. But with like American single malts, especially, it's like you can't like. Whenever I write articles about cocktails, I can't say like just American single malt because they vary so much, And like you have to be kind of brand specific a lot of times. This one to me, like I get I really love iced tea and I love just like fucking regular ass like black iced tea, and like I like anything that smells like iced tea to me, which it's like it just takes me back. It also takes me back to Oklahoma, right? So this one has like a little bit of that, but it's also got like there's something kind of spicy on the nose too, and and just kind of earthy, but it's not like, it's not peaty. It's not like scotchy peaty.
No, there's no smoke malt in it at all.
Right.
We have other ones that are coming. We'll have a little smoke malt. So our farm who grows all of our small grains. It's also a malting company. It's first craft malting company in the country. It's called Colorado Malting Company. And it's by the Cody Family Farm. They grow amazing grain, and they also know a lot about them. And then knowing a lot about them, they can create amazing malts, like very, very high specialty malts. And so in this, you're looking at, there's like Caramel 60, but it's their Caramel 60, which is like a Caramel 120. So what that means is how much it's been roasted. So the higher the number, the more roast. And in beer, that presents as color and as toasty notes. When you distill it, those can definitely modify. So this is two base malts in it, and some Abbey, which is like a toasted malt, and then some chocolate malt. So that's all present here. But the cool part about this is that it's made on grain. So most malt whiskey is steeped, right, in the cook, and let it all come out of the barley, and then they pull the liquid off and leave the grain body behind and the husks and everything.
Sure.
We don't do that. So we just keep it all together. We ferment on the grain, which is going to push a lot of the grain body and husk flavors, which is typically should present as nuttiness. So like Spanish peanuts, the skins off of, you should probably get some of that on it.
Yeah, totally.
And then because it's barley, it's super sweet. So it kind of, by about 3 or 4 years, it kind of tastes like peanut brittle. And then it starts to develop more. And this is what you have in your glass here is over 5. And what I have in front of me is the 4-year bond from a few years ago. And yeah, you're going to get those notes. And yeah, you picked up on a lot of them there. There's some earthiness to it. And that's all because it's fermented on those grains. And then we put it in the still. And for the next 6 hours, it's going to cook off on top of those gross grain bodies, which is going to, again, impart a lot of flavor to it. And because it's in a pot still, it's going to concentrate flavor even more. So
right.
It's a pretty big flavor bomb.
So, okay, I want to ask about that because for the last 4 years, I've been working in California brandy. And brandy is a hard thing for people to understand, even though it's just distilled wine. Then the closest comparison that I've made with it is like, hey, it's like whiskey, but it's made from beer instead of wine. And they're like, what? You know, there are a lot of people out there who think they're like, they're next, like, editor in chief of like Malt Advocate. They're like home enthusiasts, and they don't realize that whiskey is distilled beer. And I know we're so like nerdy about it, and we deal with it every day, but like, it's kind of interesting that you said that you're taking that beer, but you're keeping the grain in it and then distilling. So have you, on that note, have you ever, because I know that like distiller's beer is like different than like, you know, your regular like drinkable, potable beer. have you experimented with like creating the beer first as like something that that you would actually drink was it made with the like the express purpose of immediately going to be produced into a whiskey?
Always that, except for a few years ago on the malt side, we wanted to see how our grains and our processes beyond, say, the mash might change the malt whiskey. So we had Ratio Beer Works here in Denver take our grains and create us a wash. And then brought it back over and fermented it like we ferment everything else, like open air fermentation to invite in the environment and everything else that's in our facility. And then we distilled which is the way most people make malt whiskey, is to use the liquid, but we hadn't done that before. And it's distinctively different. And it's still sour mash process, so we're still adding back some things. Everything we make is again traditional style. So we're adding spent liquid from the prior batch back into it, which changes the mouthfeel and gives it a base of, I think, American whiskey, you know, is my favorite thing about it. Again, the soul. And that soul, people go, well, it's kind of like this. When you talk about Japanese whiskeys, it's so exacting, right? Specific this, blend of this. That doesn't have soul to me. It's delicious, but it lacks soul. So the flaws and the differences from batch to batch in a pot still, that's soul, right? So it makes us all different. We're all humans, and these are the things that make us different humans, right? So I'm a big fan of of those aspects of inviting in natural influences that you couldn't plan.
Absolutely. Hey, I was wondering, to me, like, Denver's got like, just, I mean, that whole area of Colorado, really, there's like, there's a lot of old and a lot of new, right? There's like, because Denver is constantly evolving, right? And it's the same as, you know, wine and spirits production. I mean, we're constantly, the technology advances, but then there's also, you can't get away from the fact that it's a fermented, you know, distilled product, you know, that we've been doing that for ages and ages, right?
Thousands of years.
Right. So, you know, like, when I think about like some of I mentioned like new places like Death and Company in newer, I guess, but like in Denver, but then like, you know, I really like places like the Buckhorn Exchange. So like when I think about, you know, especially coming from where I'm from, you know, Oklahoma, Texas, and spending a lot of my life around, you know, New Mexico and Colorado, it's like that kind of old west, southwestern thing. You know, there's still a lot of that retention of the old world, but then like a lot of modern aspects too. Is there any, like, I mean, like your bottle packaging is very much that too. It's like, it's got some nice, like, modern design, but then the juice is very, very rustic and kind of old school just by nature of being whiskey. And that's something to me that I've always found, like, not paradoxical, but like just a really cool kind of mash of old thing. And I know that like you got this started and, you know, with these awesome ingredients and like we were just talking about the different grains in Colorado, but like with, you know, doing things old school, like making your own cuts and the soul of that. Since you've started this business and kind of grown it, like, I wanted to ask about like who is working with you now? Cause like, I know it's like, you know, everything takes a village, right? You know? And
yeah, that's what we describe our whole company as a village.
Yeah. That's, yeah. Right. Exactly. On. That's cool. Perfect. Well, I was just thinking about like, you're like kind of mentoring some of the newer people. And, you know, like I was like, as a bar owner and also working in the spirits industry, mentoring the next generations of people coming in, whatever aspect, whatever area of the industry they want to get into, whether it's like journalism or bar management or mixology or, you know, distillation or, you know, is that something that, because I know that you have, you're still a very small team, right? Is that something that you constantly, I feel like you kind of have to constantly be focusing on that, like, because your brand, your juice is evolving and you've got your team that's like, obviously, like any small team's got to be very passionate. So it takes a lot of that to really want to learn, right? And to also for your side to like teach. So is there like kind of an ongoing, I mean, we're always learning, right? I mean, that's
one of the greatest things. We learn from each other, right? Like our head distiller, like we don't have a master distiller. We don't like that term. And quite frankly, if you're running the equipment and you've been there for 6 months and you've been trained, you are the master distiller. You have a lot of accountability to everyone on the team and you have to, you know, really dive into this. And this isn't something we can just go do this, spin on your toenails here and then do that. And like, this is the secret handshake thing. You have to come about it your own way. Like we can talk about giving them all whiskey here and you go, it tastes like this. And I'm like, oh, I think it tastes like this. And they have the exact two things that just present on each other's cortex the same way.
Sure.
But we're describing it differently. So we want people to be able to describe what they're doing in their own way. But we definitely spend a lot of time with them to get them to that point. And again, they have to sit around the production table and defend what they made. Not, that sounds really, you know, confrontational. It's not that way. But it's also like, how do we keep everyone involved and engaged? Because we don't want any zombies on the floor making the whiskey. So for us, it's like when we expanded the distillery, we did not automate anything. So we just simply, everyone says we don't want that. Otherwise, they don't want to sit in a lab or sit at a desk and monitor the stills. They're like, we didn't start our career in this to do that. They wanted to turn valves. They wanted to be physically in contact with what they were doing. And I said, amen. We'll do that. And
cool.
It's created quite a culture. And also, you know, to keep everyone fresh, we do one at least thing a year where like, okay, who has an idea to make something other than what we make? Because we just make whiskey, right? We don't make vodka or gin. We never did. We waited 3.5 years before we put out our right. first drop. And we made, you know, all we did is make it, make it, make it. People are like, oh, put it out. No, it's not ready. We're not putting out anything that isn't ready. And when it goes in that bottle, and you talked about our bottle and our branding is, you know, we developed the bottle because the juice is extraordinary. It deserves a good house. And so our concepts is more, you know, craftsman era. So it's a decanter kind of bottle. It's very heavy when you pick it up. It feels like something substantial. It's branded in the right. glass. All these things are really important to presenting the brand the right way. So I don't want to put out anything in the brand that then people go, oh, I had that back then. It was terrible. I'm like, then you lose. And you want that first experience to be great. And it will change. Like, obviously, we've made some modifications along the way, but we made the modifications more to our own liking as we learned things.
Sure.
But again, back to what we do once a year is let's make something different. So you talked about brandies. We like brandy. So a lot of our finishing barrels are exclusively brandy. Like Armagnac, I think, is the closest thing to American whiskey in brandy.
Sure.
So single pass, has a vintage year, all these kind of cool aspects of it, and it has a rougher finish to it. I love
it. Absolutely. Armagnac. Yeah, me too.
Cognac is about blending. Blend to perfection. Also, amazing brandy. We're a big fan of Calvados. Apple brandy made in small format for the most part. And the barrels we've got before have been like Brielle and Drouin. So we get away to the farm, and then Vicard will go pick the barrels up and recouper them for us and ship them over to us. Alain Royer is our contact. He's ex-cognac blender, retired fellow who's amazing. And helps us a lot in barrel selections. But all those things matter. So we were like, oh, is it a finish that we're doing this year that's super cool? Or are we going to make apple brandy? And we've done that. We've made plum brandy, which is the most expensive thing we've ever made. Because the yield is terrible. The product is really good. Just the yield was so bad. It's like, these barrels cost almost 2.5 times what a bourbon barrel costs to produce. So, but it's fun to have. And so every year there's something like that. And we keep people fresh and go after their desire for education or what they want to try. And it's fun to do. It's sometimes they don't work out, but very rarely have they not worked out because of the research that's gone into making them by the team.
Yeah, you got good barrels. Vicard is like one of the probably the top cooperage, I would say, in the brandy world. I was also thinking about that experimentation with your team, and like now that you have this tasting room that's opening, are any of your distillery employees like interested in like taking some shifts behind the bar and like mixing up cocktails?
Oh, that's a great question. I don't even know an answer to that. Like, we just hired a general manager, which this is our first foray really into hospitality, right? We did tours. Our tours, we take no knee to anyone in this country, whether it's Kentucky or on our tour. Our tour is awesome. You're going to learn something, whether you've known a whole bunch about this, are an expert. We've had experts from Jack Daniels come in. They want to go do a tour. Like, holy shit, man, you guys really went deep on this. Like, I've been working for Jack for 20 years. I'm like, this is kind of interesting for a small company to be teaching people all this stuff.
Yeah.
So it's awesome. So we had that, and we had this little like bottle shop, and you could get sample pour or a flight or something, but it was really tiny and really not on brand standard is what our marketing people would tell me. but this new thing is, it meets brand standard. It's a brutalist architectural design and
nice
and super cool, but we've never been in the hospitality side. So it's we're gonna walk slowly here for 6 months to figure out who we are in that space. And we want, but what you asked was very interesting, because we want the person who's making the cocktail to have the depth of knowledge of the distillers, or at least be aware of what those things are and how these things affect, so they can answer questions and provide people with not just a cocktail, but an experience, and to fill in things that they may or may not know.
Absolutely. And, being so intimate with the brands and the brand and the different marks in the lineup, And having that experience of like touching the barrels and tasting through time and like understanding like the process and the evolution of it, it really does inform, like, if you're thinking about like making a Manhattan or an old fashioned, right? And you're like,
yeah,
well, since I know that this had this one year, it was the spice over here was spiking, but yeah, then it kind of came down this next year, this next season. It's like, there's a couple of different vermouths that I think would work perfectly with this, and like try them out. And my buddy Burke has a vermouth company. You were talking about that root beer kind of flavor. And well, I'm a huge root beer fan, and he has a company called Rockwell Vermouth, and it has such amazing, like, kind of root beer tones to it. It's fucking amazing. I don't know if it's in Colorado, but it should be if it's not. But it is like, when I tasted this whiskey and I got that root beer vibe off of it, and then you said that, I was like, we gotta use Rockwell Vermouth for this. And so I actually, and he put out a limited edition barrel aged, like a bourbon barrel finish. I think it's bourbon barrel. It might have been rye. Shit, I can't remember now. But it was really rich and beautiful. And like, I actually made a Manhattan. That's why this 4 grain is so low. I made a Manhattan with it, and it was fucking fire, dude. So, you know, and that's the thing. Like, I've just tasted everything. Like, not everything, you know, but we try to taste everything. But you know, that's why I was asking about like some of your staff kind of like doing some cross. Cause another thing is like, you're going to have bartenders who come to work at that spot at the tasting room who are going to be like, you know what? I want to learn about the distillation side. They're going to want to like go back to the shop. And you know, yeah, I think that
everybody that works for Laws in the village has to spend some time on the floor and learn how to it's made. Salespeople. Yeah. Salespeople takes cool. 2 weeks of like, you got to know this. Then you have to go over to talk with, you know, you talk with Sam at the distillery. He shows you all the techniques, tells you why all these things are important, and then move you over to, you know, where the barrels are kept. We have two rick houses, and that's where the marrying happens to make blends, plus all the special finish. And then you'll work with James over there, and you're going to go through, okay, well, here's what it is at 2 years. Here's what it is at four. Here's that at eight. Here's a 10. Here are the things, and here's how it's changing. And this is what the barrels are doing to it. And then you have to even go work on the packaging line. We have a new automated, I'm going to put that in quotation marks because it doesn't quite work yet. But a line where you have to like understand, you know, this is the last thing before it goes out. So don't screw things up. And we've had, you know, corks that break and that pisses us off. And then we have to go back. We have to really pull pallets back and recork them because like the corks are all going to break because the quality of them was poor. But like you have to have all this kind of baked into you before we let you go out and talk about, you know, the Laws brand and everything else, which you might be able to learn in 2 days. You have to have this little bit more depth in texture, I'll call it. Yeah. Sure. Having touched all the pieces that are important to, you know, that final bottle that you put in someone's hand.
You know, I always say, like, when it comes to hospitality, especially in sales too, I mean, when it comes down to it, we're all in sales. Doesn't matter what you do, we're all in sales. Mm-hmm. You know, but I would say that it's like when you go to a restaurant and the waiter comes over and they start telling you the specials of the day. I can immediately tell if the chef put it out in front of them and they got to taste it and try it and experience it, mm-hmm. you know, and because like there's just a different way that they deliver, you know, the presentation of like, you know, just and then you're like, oh, shit. OK, well, you've had it and clearly you liked it and I want to try that, too. So it behooves everyone who's going to like really like champion a brand. They got to like know the ins and outs of it, because once you have that, like I said, the intimate relationship with it, then there's no stopping you, you know? So for that, I want to say that for all those listeners out there, next time you're in Dallas, cause you're talking about the oil and gas industry. Yeah. Next time you're in Denver, one of my favorite cities in the United States, you know, actually, it's the only city. When I lived in Oklahoma, I was like trying to figure out where I was going to move to next, because I'd outgrown Oklahoma City, and I was like, and I'd already kind of lived in Austin, but it was like Austin, San Francisco, Denver, or New York, and I chose New York, and then I moved out here to San Francisco, and so maybe Denver's my retirement town, so I can check all of them off the box. But yeah, if you're in Denver,
being in the Bay Area, you'll be used to the costs.
yeah, totally.
Up in Denver.
Yeah, I'm the idiot who lives in New York and San Francisco at the same time, the two most expensive states. But definitely go check it out. Denver's just got a lot of cool stuff going on, and this is definitely a great addition to all of that. The The website is Laws Whiskey House, LAWSWhiskeyHouse.com. It says that your Instagram, social media is Laws Whiskey, simply Laws Whiskey, at Laws Whiskey. So definitely go check them out there. You know, you've got this tasting room, but can you tell me what date it's opening?
Don't. The drywall goes up next week. They started putting the drywalls for the bar. You know what that means. So that's getting closer and closer.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
You know, to the last 2 weeks with my family down here, and we built the church pews. We have a whiskey church in this place. This is where you go.
That's awesome.
Get educated, get indoctrinated, that's baptized great. Into the Laws whiskey thing. So we built those this last couple of weeks, and those are all getting ready to be installed. So it's, we think, 8 weeks out. So this summer, come visit us and, you know, be patient. We're new at this, but we're going to try to rock your socks right out of the gate.
That's awesome. This has been great, man. It's nice talking to you about, like, just, I love talking about whiskey. And so, you know, we have, the great thing about this show is we get people from all over the industry, you know, from bartenders, bar managers, journalists, authors, distillers, winemakers, you know, brewers. We, you know, it covers everything. A lot of NA stuff lately, you know, like over the past few years.
Yeah.
And so it's all very fascinating and interesting. And it's, but it's also good to talk to someone from, again, one of my favorite places in the country and about one of my favorite subjects. So really appreciate you being on the show today. Al Laws, check him out at all the aforementioned places. And cool. I really appreciate you being on the show. I can't wait to come visit out and visit out there in person. And that should be probably, I mean, I think the next time I'm coming out is going to be sometime in like July or August. So I'm hoping that the whiskey church will be open.
Perfect.
I'll do a guest shift. How about that?
You shall.
All right. Till next week. That's the Speakeasy. Cheers.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock.
The Speakeasy is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food and drink radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe. It's gonna get you.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.